It's Chatter on Books, and if you think this introduction is boring, you try writing the copy. I'm Jamie McIntyre. Here's Tori Clark.
We've been rolling for 10 minutes, people. If you don't sign up for Patreon, you really should, because you get some pretty great stuff.
Like, by the way, speaking of Patreon, during the holiday break, I've got tons of bonus audio that we're going to release just for Patreon members.
Nice. And
so patreon.com/chatteronbooks. It's almost a complete show's worth of outtakes that Tori may or may not approve of me releasing, but it will be available one way or the other.
It's all the cussing, right? It's all the times you cuss.
Yes.
It's more than the cussing. And the only time I've ever gotten in trouble is when I didn't ask Claude if I could do something, and he's cleaned it up. And, you know, people, throw the canary a bird seed, for God's sake. It's what, $5 a month, Claude? We're not talking big bucks here.
Right.
$5 a month. On Starbucks.
Yeah.
Okay, everybody. Hope everybody is doing well. Welcome back to Chatter on Books. In just a little bit, we are going to be talking to this really, really interesting guy, Silas House, about this fabulous book, Lark Ascending. And Mike Crowley and I have a little bit of a backstory on this book and me reading it. And that is why we are so happy, in addition this evening to having award-winning Claude Jennings and David Aldridge, we have Mike Crowley back. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Tori. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing really well.
You know David. You know Claude.
Dude, it's good to see everybody.
You know Pinehurst number 2 is the golf course where you all will be spending the rest of your lives. And you're deserved. Enough room there for all three of you. So, Mike, we'll talk later about the book, but tell us how you are. What are you up to? How are things on campus? And a little bit, we're going to talk about a really wonderful piece you wrote recently for Esquire.
Things are all good. The end of my sabbatical is hurtling towards me like a bullet train. I have to go back to the classroom on January 16th. Not that I'm counting or anything like that.
How many young minds will you be influencing?
Oh, it's tough. 32. Just 32? Two classes. No, wait. I have 18 in sports writing and 16 in my fiction class, so 34.
Which do you enjoy teaching more?
I kind of like the sports writing class a little bit more because I haven't done it as much, so it's more of a challenge and it's newer, and so that's kind of fun. And then fiction writing, I've been doing it so long, it's a little bit like riding a bicycle, so it's enjoyable, but it's not as challenging in some ways.
That's what your students want to hear, Mike. That's what they want to hear from their faculty.
It's challenging for me to prepare. It's going to be challenging for them, but not as challenging for me to prepare.
When you do your sports writing class, do you have people zoom in, famous sports journalists, to help?
I have before. Aldridge joined us once before. Was kind enough to do that, and I've had other people join before. Wright Thompson did it once.
How was Wright Thompson, who will not? He answered an email for me once and then realized the mistake he had made and then just has blocked me out.
He was great. But the thing that was kind of weird and it was a little baddie was he did it on his iPhone, and he lives in Oxford, which is not a metropolitan area. So he was like in his backyard, and it was like being in the Blair Witch Project with him, because he kept moving around. And I almost was like, can you black your screen out before I vomit? And but he was great, and he answered all the students' questions. He was really nice and amenable.
Cool. David, do you know him?
Yes. No, I know Wright. I don't know Wright. I'm not going to pretend like I know him well, but I know Wright. I've talked to him a few times on a few different things he's written over the years. And he is, he's like Gary Smith. Like, he's one of those guys that just, when you see his byline, you just stop what you're doing because you're going to take the next 45 minutes to read this thing. You're going to find out 10 unbelievable things in it.
Yeah.
He's amazing.
I think I was in that group of anything he would write, I would read. And then he wrote some book about Pappy Van Winkle, right? The whiskey.
Yeah.
And I thought, this is made for Chatter on Books. Yeah. Swear to God, answered the first email. And then it was like, fast enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Just went the other direction. Okay. Does anybody know Buzz Bissinger?
Yes, I know Buzz.
No, of him. I don't know him.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. From Friday Night Lights. Yeah.
Friday Night Lights. A lot of other stuff, but from Friday Night Lights.
Yes.
And he has this book out called The Mosquito Bowl, mm-hmm. right? Football, Minnesota. And I thought, again, And so usually someone like that, you have to go through 9,000 people. But, you know, I usually, when there's somebody I really want, I'll find 15 different ways to reach out. One of which was, he has a website. He's like, you know, contact me. So I sent an email and I just like, you know, blah, 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 blah. Here's the show. Here's David Aldridge, throwing David's name around shamelessly. And there's this little riff about, you know, famous people we've had on, like Mike Crowley, and here's how we do it. It's so much fun. It'll be the greatest thing you've ever done. And it's a couple of paragraphs, but it's fun. I get an email right back. Sure. Period. That's it. Like, sure. Like, okay. So then I said, how about I shoot you some dates? Sure. I sent some dates and I, you know, it's January 9th. Sounds good. That's it. That's the extent of the conversation. So hopefully he will show up on January
9th. He'll show up.
No, he's an interesting guy. I mean, have you done a lot of research on him?
Yeah, a little bit. Go ahead, share.
Hey, well, he had this, I mean, he wrote about it for GQ. He had this really weird year when he got into leather. Like he was wearing all leather all the
this
time.
This is for our Patreon patrons, Clyde. For like an entire year. Not right now. So the people listening to the show will go,
I'm not like letting the cat out of the bag. He's written about it. But I mean, like, it was like really, but I mean, like very, it was like, I think it was like all like high end, like Gucci and Prada and all this stuff. But it was like leather on skin. It was a very... It was more than you wanted to know about him.
That's what I always say, you know, but half my friends are golf people and half my friends are horse people. And I always say, because the accoutrement, the attire and the accoutrement in golf are just appalling. And in the horse world, we got leather, we got some whips, we got some spurs. It's just so much better. So much better.
So, Mike, how was the, I mean, I have a dear friend of mine who's a professor. She just came back last semester from sabbatical.
Yeah.
And I just wonder what, she just loved that she didn't have to commute. That was the thing that made her happiest. That she didn't have to commute for a year and a half. What was the best part of that?
I think, you know, it's one of those things that I think some people beat professors up about, but I think the best part is just being able to be in your own head and do your own work and not tend to your other responsibilities. I mean, I think that teaching can be great, but, you know, answering emails about the syllabus when it's right in front of them, like that gets old sometimes, right? Like, did you read the syllabus? So I think it's really just the time, like, Lee Smith, who will come up in this conversation because she's one of Silas's mentors too. She used to always tell us, like, you need a lot of staring out the window time to be a writer. And that's really all it is. I mean, so I think that's really the best thing about it is just sort of being in your own head, not feeling like you have to answer to, like, there's also like committee work and department meetings and all that stuff. You don't have to worry about any of the politics of anything for a couple of months. You can just focus on yourself and your work. And you do come back a little bit. You come back charged. I mean, I definitely feel fresher than I have in a long time. So
nice. How often do students come to you via email or any other and complain about their grades?
Not often. I don't get that a lot.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? Oh, because I've got a friend on. So he teaches at the University of Delaware. He's on sabbatical now in Paris. yeah, it's a rough life. Anyways, he just the endless emails. You know, they get a. It's usually ones who are actually doing better, but they've not done as well as they think they should be doing. So, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a lot of that. There's a lot of problems with grading in the academy.
Okay, Mike, you have been busy on your sabbatical, including some pretty incredible writing. And I don't want to step on your thunder. So tell us about the piece that appeared in Esquire recently, what it's about, why you wrote it.
Yeah, so I've been writing a lot. My brother passed in May of 21 and sort of kind of, unfortunately, you know, he had the type of cancer. It was pretty slim that he would survive. So I'm a pretty typical writer. I was thinking even while he was still alive, like, what am I going to do if this happens? How will I memorialize him? How will I think about him and how will I sort of manage my grief? And I wrote a piece in January that was in Golf Digest about dedicating myself to getting better at golf because I was terrible.
He was the better golfer, right? Your brother was the better golfer.
He was much better than me. Yeah. And so a guy read this and reached out to me and said, I read your piece. I had a brother who also passed away from lung cancer. I would love it if you would come to Chicago and play golf with me. And at first I didn't really say this in the piece in Esquire, because that's what that piece is about, is actually going to visit him at the end of 7 months of golf. But I kind of thought, like, this is a little crazy. But my wife was like, you should go. Like, you should say yes to, she said, say yes to everything this year. I was like, okay. So I was like, all right, man, I'll do it. I'm in. And then I emailed him in March because the piece came out in January. I was like, hey, we should probably get something on the calendar because I assumed he'd be busy. Mm-hmm. And so we set it up. And so I went to all these places. I've talked to Claude about this. I went to a lot of bucket list destination places.
Such as?
I went to Bandon Dunes. I went to Stream Song in Florida. I went to the west coast of Ireland and played this new course called St. Patrick's. I got to play Sand Hills in Nebraska, which is like the number six course in the world, I think, in the latest rankings. I went to Cabot Links, Cape Breton, I think they're now calling it, in Nova Scotia. I went everywhere. I played the ocean course in Kiowa in March.
Can I just, I'm going to interrupt, and just on behalf of spouses everywhere, your wife is a saint. I realized, she realized this was a really important thing for you and your group, and I get that. And
I probably could have done more in the essay, but I tried to make clear that she encouraged me to do this because she knew how important it was to me. And so I think, you know, I made this in a couple social media posts too. I think from the outside, it might have looked like you're saying, like, man, this guy's got the greatest life ever. Like, who's his wife? Why did she let him do this? But I was chasing something, although it seems frivolous from the outside. It was actually much more existential. Mm-hmm. And that's what the piece in Esquire was about, was just trying to sort of work through my grief. And what was interesting was I met a lot of people that had also had their own losses, and I think that the piece resonated with them. The stuff I was doing resonated with them, and I found comfort in strangers that I did not expect to find, because I'm not someone that would normally seek that out.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got to Chicago, his name is Pat Canning. You know, Pat was just so much nicer than I expected him to be. And one of the things I liked about our time together was, like, we did not talk about it a lot. We knew why we were there together. We didn't have to talk about what happened to your brother, what happened to your brother. I mean, we did, but we did talk about it at length. We actually talked about it more whenever I sold the piece to Esquire. I was like, all right, I got to interview you for a couple of minutes, you know. But I like that, too, because I think we both knew we were, and that was the heart of the piece, was that, you know, he told me when I got home, you have no idea how much, I sent him a note of thanks, and he said, you have no idea what you did for me and how therapeutic it was to be with you. Mm. And I was really blown away by that, because I only thought about his graciousness towards me. I'd never thought about that I was doing anything for him.
Yeah.
And then I just started, I always thought I would write something about it, but that really changed the piece. And it really sort of made me understand, I think, how much I would have lost myself if I had quit playing golf.
Mm-hmm.
If I had not had something.
You thought about it, right? Didn't you think about it? Yeah.
Yeah. I think if I hadn't moved into my grief in that way, because my sister-in-law said to me at one point, she goes, I don't know how you do this. Like, how do you keep going to these places and writing about it? I was like, I don't know what else to do. I was but I understood what she meant, but I think the visit to Chicago made me realize, like, if I had not done this, I would probably be in almost as bad a shape as I was when he first passed.
Mm-hmm.
I think kind of like facing the grief every time, because I miss him every time I'm out there. There's always a moment every round I think really hard about him. And there's always a moment every round I have to walk away from everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
But that's been very helpful to do, because in a way, it allows me not to sort of feel performative or grieve in front of other people. And then, you know, other people feel weird.
Yeah.
They're sorry. Sure. So I think that's been the best thing about it. And then just these men that I met who, you know, one thing that was really interesting was a guy I did not expect to meet. You know, I kind of told him in passing, because it's hard to not tell people what's going on.
Why are you here?
Yeah. And he was just like, he was almost like instantaneously comforting, and immediately shared, you know, that he lost both his parents within 27 days.
Oh,
27 days. And then I think it was only a year prior to that, he lost his best friend of 20 some odd years. And So he's like, I know what you're going through. And that was nice, but I was really touched. We took a picture together, and like, he put his arm around me, like he squeezed me really hard, you know, and we had only met each other 2.5 hours ago.
Yeah.
And I think that was the other thing I wanted to get across in the piece too, is, you know, golf rightfully gets beat up for lots of reasons. It's very bougie. It's very patrician.
Yeah.
You know, it's not always been welcoming to people who look like me and Claude. Right. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, golf can do some amazing things because you just get to spend so much time with people out there. Right. And you can really get to know a stranger pretty well in about 4.5 hours. You can also realize you want to get the hell away from them forever.
Mike, as you and I have discussed, you're out there for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's in, well, here's what I find interesting. If it were not for me, my husband, Brian, God bless him, would have no social life, would have none. Right. It just, the only reason he relates to other people other than work is because we're going to dinner now, or we're going to do this or whatever. And he just doesn't like hanging out with people he doesn't know and those kinds of things, which I think is pretty typical for a lot of guys. But your willingness to go to some golf course and walk up to some starter and like, sure, I'll go out with this perfect stranger for 4.5 hours. Yeah. That's insane. Commitment.
It's potluck. I mean, I've had some bad pairings before.
Yeah. You told me about one. That was pretty great. Yeah. Pretty great. I just couldn't imagine. I can't. I'm too twitchy. I couldn't do anything. If I couldn't stand somebody, no, I'm out. Whole three or whole four. Have I ever told the story in this show about the first time Bush 41 saw Bill Clinton after Bill Clinton cleaned his clock in 92? It's some years Clinton's president, or maybe even an ex-president this time. Somebody sets up a foursome. Bush 41 retired, Clinton, I think ex-president, and a couple of guys. And they go out to golf. And Bush 41, if you knew anything about his golfing, was a speed golfer. Hit the ball, goes, he was a terrible golfer. Hit the ball, goes fast as possible. He would get it done in 1.5 hours, right? So that, why don't, I can't remember where they were playing. But they, you know, first tee, and of course there are lots of people. There are people at the course, it's a public course, and they're caddy, and 41's ready to go. And Clinton, God bless him, wants to talk to the caddies. He wants to talk to people in the shop. He wants to talk to people. Do you want a picture taken with me? These kinds of things, whatever. This goes on for 4 or 5 holes. And swear to God, 41 turns to Clinton and says, Jesus, now I know why you beat me. You love every single person out here. It was really true. It took them days to finish the balls of golf. Yeah, it was great. Okay. Oh, I see Silas. Silas, how are you?
I'm good. How are y'all?
Good. Thank you for joining us.
Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you fine with the beautiful, beautiful cover of your book, Lark Ascending, behind you. Okay, first and foremost, how do you know Mike Crowley? Mike Crowley, how do you know Silas?
You go first, Silas.
Well, we grew up just about 7 or 8 miles from each other, but we didn't meet until Mike was in his early 20s, I guess. He was in college. We met at a writing workshop.
Both from southeastern Kentucky?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, well, Silas, by way of your backstory, by way of introduction, who you are, where you're from, what you wanted to be when you're 5, I want you to talk about something. I think it happened in early December in Corbin, Kentucky.
Mm-hmm.
You were honored by the city of Corbin, Kentucky, even though you're technically from Lilly. Can you tell us about that and why they honored you with a key and everything else?
Well, when you're from Lilly, it's Corbin is the nearest real town. Because Lilly is just like a gas station, a school, a post office, you know. And so growing up, when we went to town, we went to Corbin. And so even if you're in southeastern Kentucky, you can't just say I'm from Lilly. You'd have to say I'm from near Corbin, you know. So anyway, yeah, it was very nice of them to do that. I had never done a reading at that library, and I've been published 22 years. So it was a long time coming.
It was, but you got a key to the city.
Yes.
The mayor named you a Corbin Colonel. Is that cool? Did you really want that designation?
Well, the first Kentucky Fried Chicken's in Corbin. That's why that is.
No.
How about that?
Wow. I had different ideas of why you were. kernels, but that, yeah, that is spectacular. Oh, that's great. Okay, so annoyingly for us, Savas, you are not only this award-winning author, you're one of these freaks of multi-talents. So you're an artist, you're a musician, you teach, all of these things. Of all the things you do, including writing these wonderful books like Lark Ascending, which do you find the most challenging, the most fulfilling? Why?
What I most identify as is a novelist, and I think that's where I'm most comfortable. It's, but at the same time, it's probably the most challenging, and maybe that's why I prefer it. I feel sort of like a fraud when I'm doing other things.
About imposter syndrome on this show a lot, so yeah.
Well, I have imposter syndrome as a novelist too, but I feel like I've been better trained as a novelist than anything else. And I put a lot of store in being trained as a writer. Uh-huh. And sometimes I'm bothered by how many writers I encounter who just sort of decide that they're going to write and, you know, then sure, next week they write a book. Yeah.
Yeah, we talk about Colleen Hoover on this show a lot, too. Nobody ever taught her how to write, and, you know, tens of millions of books later. Okay, Mike Crowley, what makes Silas House a good writer?
Well, he's got a great story. I mean, we grew up close to home, so I think for me, I read him differently than maybe other people do, but I think the things that make Silas a good writer are the things that make anybody a good writer. He's got a real sense of place, which makes all his books stand out. I mean, Lark Ascending is a much different book than he's done before because it's not set in Kentucky. But it still has that real sense of place, a sense of nature, a sense of being part of, you know, being one with the world. And I find his books are always very immersive that way. He immerses you in a physical environment, and then that always allows you to sort of inhabit the people, too, in a much different way. And I think that's the thing that's always made him such a great writer is, like, there's nothing just on the surface. He always tries to get you down below and really deep into his characters. And I think even when he was really young, in his 20s when I met him, he always had that about him. And I think that's always what separated him and allowed him to have as much success as he did early on, too, is he really put people, and not just people from Appalachia, because I think what people don't understand about Appalachia is it's really a stepsister of the South, right? Like, nobody in Alabama gives you any truck for right. Appalachia, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that allowed him to build a big readership outside of Appalachia was the way that he was able to sort of show the complexity of lives of people back home, which is something that I think we were always concerned with growing up. You know, I mean, it wasn't just good old boys. You know, we had pharmacists, we had doctors, we had attorneys. You know, those people live there too. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think Silas did a good job of getting the whole tapestry of those places into his books.
Okay. Speaking of, and segueing, I mean, diverting from the book for a second, but I promise we'll talk about Lark Ascending. Silas, but in addition to everything else you're doing, music, art, everything, photography, the documentary Hillbilly?
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about that. I read about it and I thought, okay, every week, usually it's early in the week, I say to myself, I'm not binge watching anything this week. I'm going to sleep between 2 and 4 a.m. And by Wednesday, I've blown it. So now I know Wednesday or Thursday between 2 and 4, I'll be watching this. But tell us about this documentary, which is fascinating, including the story. Is it Billy Redden? Is that his name from Deliverance? Tell us about the documentary.
Well, I was featured very briefly for maybe 2 minutes in a great film done for PBS about mountaintop removal coal mining.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the directors of that film, she joined forces with another director, and they wanted to make a movie about Appalachian stereotypes and the way the media, meaning films and TV, have perpetuated those stereotypes since the beginnings of cinema. And so they reached out to me to a service consultant, and we just really hit it off and had a nice rapport. And so then they asked me to write the treatment because, you know, a documentary, even though it's not written, obviously, you still have to write a film to gain grants and things like that. You have to have a whole structure. You have to have dialogue and everything sort of. And so I wrote the film, the treatment of the film, and we got some good grants. And then I became, I am an executive producer on Hillbilly. And so what people think that means is that I gave money for the movie to be made. But what an executive producer actually does is make things happen. And so I was, the main thing I did was get talent. So in other words, if they want Bell Hooks, you know, to, if they want to interview Bell Hooks, then it was my job to get Bell Hooks to convince Bell to do it. And so I did. And, you know, and things like that.
Yeah.
And so I'm also one of the subjects of the film as well. There are five main subjects of the film. And I'm sort of representing gay Appalachia in the film. One of the main goals of Hillbilly, number one, is to let Appalachian people tell their own story, which is very rarely done on film. Number two, we wanted to show Appalachia as a much more diverse place than it's usually shown. Now, it is a less diverse place than other places in the United States. However, we do have diversity. And so we wanted different kinds of people to be on screen telling their different kinds of stories. So that might mean, you know, race, class, where you're from in Appalachia. People forget there's an urban Appalachia, et cetera, you know. And so we were, well, I was really surprised that Hulu ended up buying the film. And we won Best Documentary at the LA Film Festival. And we won Best Documentary from the Foreign Press Association. And
tons of awards.
It's been all over the world.
Okay, but we can find it. Us Americans can find it on Hulu, right?
Well, now you can stream it anywhere.
Okay.
I mean, you can pay like $2 and stream it anywhere.
Okay.
But what happened was, while we were making the movie, the Trump's first campaign for president was happening. And so the film becomes a lot about that, because right away, Appalachia was sort of the epicenter of what became known as Trump country. And so once again, those stereotypes were being used, you know, against all Appalachians.
Sure.
And so it looks at that.
Yeah.
I it's funny you mention that. One of my best friends from college is from West Virginia and has been there her whole life. And I've been trying to, she is dyed in the wool progressive, as blue as you can be living in West Virginia. And you know how that can be, right? And to your point, there's thousands of people in, you know, like there's lots of people who are progressive in West Virginia that just kind of get overwhelmed by the numbers. And I just, she always talks about the fact that she never sees herself in films and on TV, you know, and she was a reporter for many years, but it just, it's amazing that, and I don't, you know, you don't think about that. I mean, I think about stereotyping in a whole different way. Right. But I never thought about the notion that there are people who are that whole kind of Southern redneck thing that you associate with everyone, right, in the South, and that there's that is something that's a boulder that isn't, that must be incredibly hard to push up the hill every day.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Pop question for everybody. And let's see, I'm going to go in alphabetical order. So David, Michael, Silas, Hillbilly Elegy, good or bad?
Would be my answer to that.
Thank you. Mike?
Bad. Couldn't read.
Silas?
Horrific.
Exactly. And, you know, I think I said that at the time when that book came out. I said, here's the deal. It was like, what was that book? Cheryl, I can't forget her name. She hiked the Pacific Coast Highway.
Wow.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you. Wow. As long as they stay focused on their personal experience and just shared their personal experience, good.
Yeah.
Then they would immediately tilt into, I'm a psychologist, I'm an anthropologist, I'm a sociologist, I can explain what all this means. Sucked. He was completely wrong. Okay, should we talk about your fabulous book, Silas? Book Sending? Really fabulous. Great cover art. Someday I want to do a show, guys, just on the cover art of these books, because this is pretty spectacular. So, Silas, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but ostensibly this is about a young guy, not too distant future, dystopian Ethiopia. He has to flee the United States because he can't live here anymore. Crosses the Atlantic, thinks he's going to be saved, but he's not. But I think it is about much bigger things. But give us the less than 30-second snapshot plot of Lark Ascending.
Yeah, I think that it's about a young man who is trying to survive with his family, and they have to flee their country. They're on a crowded refugee boat, and he's the only one who makes it to Ireland, which is the country they're aiming for, where they think they're sanctuary. And when he gets there, all he knows is the name of a settlement that he's supposed to be heading toward for this sanctuary. And he meets a dog. He doesn't think there are any dogs left for complicated reasons. And he also meets an older woman, and the three of them sort of survive together walking across Ireland. And he's trying very hard to trust the woman. She's trying hard to trust him. All three of them, the woman, Helen, the dog, Seamus, and Lark, are in deep grief. And they all trust the dog.
Yeah.
But they don't quite trust each other.
Yeah. Why the refugee boat? Why the refugee ship?
Well, I was, first of all, the whole book grows out of grief, personal grief. I lost somebody really close to me around the time I started writing the book. But also I was feeling like I was losing my country. And I was also losing a lot of people that I loved in that. I lost my respect for them. And to see the sort of regime they were supporting and even defending, it was a kind of death for me. And I had to grieve the loss of those people.
I'm sorry, you started writing 2015, 2016?
Yeah, about 2016.
Okay, yeah. Regime is the correct word. Sorry.
Yes. And also, I was, you know, I think there's a collective grief that a lot of us have felt about the demise of democracy, witnessing climate change, witnessing police brutality. You know, we have all seen, at least one murder before our very eyes in the last few years on television. Just waves and waves of this sort of, you know, sadness that a lot of us have experienced together. And so I was writing about that. I was writing about losing my country, and I was writing about personal grief. And I was also thinking a lot about climate change. And I think one of the biggest seeds for the role of climate change in this book is when Australia burned. Mm-hmm. So much of Australia burned that estimates are that 1 billion animals perished in those fires. And when I first heard that, I just couldn't stop thinking about it. And so I had to write about it. Mm-hmm. You know? And so I was thinking, you know, if that happened here, and I was looking at a lot of climate change scenarios, and a lot of them were saying, you know, the West, which we're seeing more and more of it burn, and then the South. And so a lot of the country would be pushed into the Northeast. And so then as the Northeast, I thought about if the Northeast was consumed, people would have to, you know, get on boats. And also I think it's real easy for us as Americans to hear about refugee crises in the world.
It's not us.
And be sad about it, but then like, well, there's nothing I can do about that. And, you know, I just got to go on. Mm-hmm. It's not a meanness. It's not a hatefulness. I think it's just sort of an apathy that's sort of you have to push through or something. Anyway, I wanted to put us in refugee boats, mm-hmm. put Americans in those boats.
Right. With few survivors.
And literally put, you know, us in the shoes of refugees. And so that's how I got in the refugee boat. And so when I had that idea, I thought I'm going to read a lot. I thought I would read a lot of books about sea voyages, you know. So I read Moby Dick, and I read Kidnapped.
Did you hate Moby Dick? Please tell us you hated Moby Dick.
I loved it.
Show's over. Claude, cut.
Right now, I hated the middle, but I loved the beginning.
800 pages? You hated the middle 800 pages?
Yeah. I loved the beginning and I loved the end. But the main book that was really important to me was Kidnapped for Robert Louis Stevenson.
Oh, good. Yeah, great one.
And so that book made me want to write an adventure story. Mm-hmm. And I think we have a lack of adventure stories nowadays. I mean, we have too many action hero stories, you know, superhero mm-hmm. stuff, but not enough true adventure stories, like real odysseys. And yeah. So that's what I was thinking of Larkasinan as, a real odyssey, a real adventure book.
Which it is. And I'm terrible because I'm just a completely visual thinker. And as I'm reading a book and I listened to it as well, I think after we're done taping the show, I'll tell you the backstory Mike and I have about this book. So I could see the scenes. I could see the scenes of the three of them and what they went through. One of the words that comes up in so many people who have written and talked about this book is plausible. It's in the not too distant future. Sure, it sounds crazy to think Americans fleeing the United States, but I mean, plausible. Was that a hard balance to strike? Did editors have notes? Did people who read earlier drafts go, wait a minute, no, this is never going to happen? Because I found it completely plausible.
No, nobody ever said that. I mean, and you know, the main reason that I had that thought was because more and more, every cocktail party I was going to, there would be this round robin of, where are we going to go?
Yeah.
What are we going to do? Like, if this happens in the midterms, or sure. if he gets elected or whatever, where are we going to go? How are we going to, what's our backup plan?
Yeah.
And so that made me think a lot of people are thinking about leaving. And so I'm just going to make it real in the book.
Yeah. Well, just a public service announcement for everyone listening. Next year, ostensibly to go to the Women's World Cup, my husband and I and family will be spending a lot of time in New Zealand and Australia. It's just a little advance trip. It's just a little advance trip. Just in case. Mike Crawley, you're our Silas House expert here this evening. Is this his most personal book? As in things that are personally important to him? And I know Southernmost. That's the one I know best, but
yeah.
Previous book. But is this his most personal?
Well, it's probably a better question for him. I mean, I know
the background. I'm trying to include you and David. Come on.
No. I mean, I know the background of the grief story and I know why he wrote it, but I think what I would say about it is it's, in a way, it's his most wayfaring book. I mean, I think it's very, you know, before Silas got on, it'd be like David saying, I'm going to stop covering the NBA and I'm going to start covering hockey. I'm going to do this thing that I kind of know, but I don't know it great.
I don't know anything about hockey. So
I'm going to do that. And it's not that I know he's traveled to Ireland, but I think, you know, we grew up in a place where that place, the terrain actually shapes you. It's a little, sounds a little new agey and mystical, but it's actually true. Mm. And the social values of that place really sort of, you kind of accept or reject them, or you try to make some weird peace with them. Mm-hmm. You kind of spend your whole life doing that. At least I know he and I have done that, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's different for Silas because he's never left Kentucky and I left a long time ago, but yet I kind of carry it with me everywhere. So I think it's a personal book in the sense that I like that he challenged himself to write about someplace that wasn't home, that wasn't just Kentucky. And I know Southernmost did that too, but I think like really extricate himself that way was a big leap. And I was really, as his friend and as a writer, I was really proud of him for it. So I think it's personal in that way. But I feel like maybe some of those earlier books might be closer to his story in some ways too. But
interesting. So, Silas, you go on the book tour with Lark Ascending, and I'm presuming you expected, I mean, the dog, Seamus, is just the best. I mean, he had me with the dog, so that's good. And questions about the older woman and questions about Ireland, but you got a lot of questions and people coming up and talking to you about grief, right? And aren't we glad that Tori booked this one for the holiday season? It's perfect. Well, Silas, talk about the people who came up to you and how this book touched them.
I think the recurring thing I kept hearing was that a lot of them felt they hadn't been able to grieve properly because of the pandemic. A few people, you know, told me that loved ones, they didn't get to be with their loved ones as they were dying because of COVID. others told me they didn't get to have, you know, the proper funeral service, a memorial service, or, you know, a real social gathering the way they wanted to. And I think one of the main things, though, was that so many people had been really alone in their grief because of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not able to get out and be social as they would have done otherwise. And so most of it grew out of just, you know, the way the pandemic changed the way we grieve. But also, I think that as much as we are so open as a culture to talk about mental health now, and, you know, people will talk openly about therapy and things like that in a way they certainly didn't when I was growing up. On the opposite side of that, when I was growing up and in the place where we grew up, grief was a very public thing.
Yeah.
And it was very talked about all the time, very openly. And I think that's changed somewhat. I think people are more private in their grief now than they used to be. I don't understand why, but a lot of people were complaining about that. Some of it may be that we're just not as social as we used to be because the internet connects us in a different kind of way, but it's not social like being together. Anyway, when I was writing the book, I knew that I was drawing on my own grief, but I really did not expect to talk about it as much as I have. I didn't know that it would come through that much, and I didn't know that so many people felt the same way, really, that I did about all of that.
Yeah. You know? And has every beagle owner in the world come to you and said, yes, I have a beagle, and his name, and they show you pictures? Because she was a beagle.
I have gotten a lot of that. I have gotten the only thing that people have argued with me about this book is that especially beagle owners write to me and say that it was hard for them to believe that the beagle was quiet.
Totally.
I have a quiet beagle. He is so quiit that it first gave me the idea that a dog could survive that way by being taught to be quiet.
What is your beagle's name, and is he deaf? Because I'm thinking that's the only way he could possibly.
No, his name is Ari, and he will. I mean, he does bark, but it's very rare for him to bark. You know, he'll only bark if somebody knocks at the door. That's it.
Yeah.
And
that's pretty good. Pretty unusual.
And he quits right away. So he is a quiet beagle, but that is hard for some people to believe.
I wanted to get back to the grief for a second, because isn't grief really just witness? Isn't that what grieving is?
Mm.
It's telling people about the people you loved and why they were important to you. And when that's cut off because you can't assemble with other people, it really is painful in a completely different way than the actual grieving process.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And we talked a lot about the way that it sounds kind of corny to say it out loud, but we all know it's true, that grief is really just, it's that, and I'm not the first person to say this. I don't know who originally said it, but you know, it's unexpressed love. It's the love that you didn't get to express to that person that you're grieving. And so that really resonated with me the first time I heard that. Anderson Cooper has a wonderful podcast about grief.
Yes, he does.
Fabulous podcast.
There's an amazing episode that he does, a conversation with Stephen Colbert.
It's unbelievable.
If you get a chance, listen to it.
Yeah.
Every time I watch it, I cry. And just out of gratitude, not because I'm sad, but because I understand exactly what Stephen Colbert is saying when he's talking about that.
Yep. Okay. Trying to turn this just slightly. You have all these other things you do in your life, Silas, the photography, the art, the music. He's a musician. All these other things. How do they impact your writing? And I apologize because I don't know where I saw it, but I saw this great event you did somewhere in which you were showing paintings that influenced your writing, including paintings that influenced Lark Ascending. But talk about how, because we often ask authors, you know, what writer influenced you, or where did you learn this, and who taught you this, or whatever. But it's always about writing influencing their writing. Other things influence you, right?
Yeah, when I'm working on a novel, I tend to not look at other novels that are thematically similar, you know, or anything like that. Instead, I look at other mediums that can inform that. So, you know, for this book, I didn't look at any kind of speculative or dystopian fiction at all. No. Instead, I turned, like I said, to literature from the far past.
Have you read Station 11? Do you hate it?
I love Station 11.
It was good. Yeah. Tori, it was good.
I had to do a book report. No, what did I do the book report on? Invisible Man. I flunked.
Invisible Man. You were
different topics. Go on. You didn't read dystopian novels. Good for you.
I always gather a bunch of poetry. To whatever novel I'm working on, I look for poetry that's going to inform it. And so, obviously, for this one, it was a no-brainer to look to Irish poets like Yeats, Seamus Heaney, Evan Boland were the main three. And, of course, Irish music. And the title of the song is, you know, also the title of one of the greatest pieces of classical music ever written.
Yeah.
By Vaughan Williams. He tended to compose, you know, about the natural world. And, of course, there's a lot of that in here.
Mm-hmm.
Also, that song, Larkasinden, is an adventure story. It's a 14-minute adventure of emotion and, you know, you can physically move through it. Anyway, I also looked at a lot of paintings, especially of the sea. Homer, of course, you know, being one of the main ones because he did so much of the sea. Turner. Lots of paintings. I can't remember the name of the artist right now. I looked at a lot of photographs. You know, the main challenge for this book was writing the transatlantic crossing because, I mean, I've been to Ireland. I've been to the United States. Of course, I have never been on a refugee boat in the middle of the Atlantic. And so that's what I really had to do my research on. And I had to really immerse myself. And so I listened to recordings of storms at sea.
Wow.
And I looked at a lot of film and photographs, and especially somehow paintings conjured it for me better than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it was something about the quality of light that you can see in paintings that isn't quite captured in other forms. But that was the most interesting and challenging part.
Yeah. Okay. So if Southernmost, one of your other great books, was about empathy, is there one word that describes Larkasinden?
Survival. Yeah.
Mike, you've read the book. Is that what you would have said?
I would have gone with hope, but I like survival.
Yeah.
Hope, survival, or grief.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. I want to read the back. Okay. I've got something really great to wrap this up before we subject him to 60 seconds more. David, anything else from you, my friend?
It was great. It was a great book.
Yeah.
This is terrific.
Okay. So Lou Byard is a good friend of the show, Silas. And he told me, which is true. He says, oh my God, Silas has got the greatest voice anywhere. But I'm going to read.
Brokatus right now. So.
Yeah, he's got a pretty good voice. And if you've not seen the pictures of Lou at the premiere of Pale Blue Eye, which comes out in theaters on December 23rd to be on Netflix in January, he's wearing a spectacular suit. I do not know the designer, but it was blue. It was spectacular. Anyways,
I love Lou, and I love his writing. The Pale Blue Eye is such a beautiful novel. I'm so glad it's been made into a film.
And it's getting good buzz. It's getting some good buzz, so fingers crossed. Okay, here's what he said about Larkasinden, a dystopian classic finding new notes of peril and possibility in the once and future homeland of Ireland and giving us the kind of richly observed alternative family that humanity of any era would call savior. That's a nice line. That humanity of any era would call savior. It also has the best dog ever, except you my own. Don't miss this one. So, Silas, are you an optimist or a pessimist about humanity and why?
That's sort of the question I was asking myself when I was writing the book, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think what I lit on was that as long as you have hope, you can keep going. You know, that one little ember of hope keeps you going. And I think that's what Lark learns, is that sometimes you have to keep going and sometimes you have to be still. And one of those two things will allow you to survive. I'm pretty pessimistic about the state of our nation right now. And it boggles my mind that we did not have more safeguards in place to stop what has happened. I think a lot of people should be in jail right now for what happened on January 6th. A lot more people should be in jail. A lot more famous people should be in jail for what happened on January 6th. I did write the book before that. And, you know, an insurrection has taken place in Lark Ascendon. So I guess my pessimism was right on that note. I can't wrap my mind around the fact that so many people are still on board with some of this stuff. It's just unbelievable to me. And so that makes me pessimistic.
Okay, but the book, I think, is optimistic. If you talk about what may be going on, what is going on in the country, our country right now, in this very, you know, hopefully small microcosm of history and civilization, right? But humanity, I think the book is full of, it's about friendship.
Yeah.
It's about working together. It's about, you know, overcoming, exceeding, surpassing what may be the day-to-day whatever's. Despite what you say, I found it very optimistic.
Oh, I don't mean that. I just mean that I'm pessimistic about where we're going as a country, not about the book. In the book, what I kept returning to was this, you know, I wanted Lark to really, his main goal is to hold on to his humanity, even in these extraordinary obstacles. He didn't want to lose his humanity. And so I really do believe that most people are good and most people are trying their best to be good. But where I get pessimistic is I think the really bad people are the ones that always, you know, get in power because you have to be really, really terrible to get that much power.
You got to be really terrible and you got to have absolutely nothing else to do. I mean, most of these people hold, let's just go there. Elected office these days, you wouldn't hire them to run a bake sale.
Right.
You wouldn't. They've got nothing better to do.
Yeah, exactly. But
my favorite thing, not to give anything away, well, we'll talk later about the very end of the book, but near the end, Lark is given an opportunity to be just a normal human being, to make the decision that most people would make. And he says, nope. And he does the right thing. I was cheering when I read that.
Thank you. Yeah, that's my favorite moment in the book. We're talking in vague ways here now because it might give away a plot, but the third act is my favorite part of the book. And I didn't know any of that was going to happen, that he would have that final obstacle until it just sort of presented itself.
The plot unfolds organically for you when you're writing a book like this?
Pretty much. Yeah.
Wow. Mike, organic? Are you a you know, Excel spreadsheet Ken Follett guy, or are you a seat of the pantser?
Oh no, I would be the fun of writing like that.
Hey Chatterheads, it's Jamie here with a couple of quick items before you go. First of all, thanks so much for listening. We really appreciate your time. There are, however, a few things you can do to help us keep Chatter chugging along. Of course, you can follow us in all the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join us on Patreon for bonus outtakes from the show, including Tori's rapid-fire lightning round with the guest and some pre- and post-show persiflage that we usually edit out. Go to chatteronbooks.com to subscribe to our monthly newsletter, where you'll get a sneak peek at the upcoming authors. And don't forget, if you're buying books, please try bookshop.org. It's easy, it's online, and the best thing is you'll be supporting your favorite independent bookstores and affiliates like Chatter on Books. So download us wherever you get your podcasts. Give us a review on Apple if you're feeling so disposed. But, you know, most importantly, just stay in touch. Send questions, comments, ideas, and even insults to info@chatteronbooks.com. That's info@chatteronbooks.com. And thanks again for listening. Stay safe. We'll see you next time.
The book is Lark Ascending. The author is Silas House. It's really fabulous. It's really, really fabulous. Beautiful book. Again, the visual imagery is incredible. And I encourage everybody to go out there. It's still time for the holidays, kids. Go to your local independent bookstore. Go to bookshop.org. Get Lark Ascending. It's fabulous. Silas, thank you for joining us. Mike Coley, thank you for making it happen. David, Claude, my friends, and I want to thank a few other people because we are off for the next 2 weeks, holidays, everything. And then we're going to come back in January. Hopefully Buzz Bissinger shows up.
He'll show up.
Andrew Marinus, lots of good authors coming up in 2023. In the meantime, I want to thank Jamie, two Robs, Rob and Rob, you know who you are. Ed, Patty, Mary, Claire. Oh my God, Claire, the best. Neil, and everybody else who's listening, thank you so much. Thank you for your notes. Thank you for listening. Everybody stay well. Have a great holiday. And we will see you all and hear you all in 2023. Thanks, guys. We are out.